It's not my fault. I didn't ask to be kidnapped. I didn't ask to be made some sort of savior bride. I'm doing the best I can. It turns its head, blinks one beady yellow eye. Then, with a flutter of wings and spread of an enormous multicolored fan tail, it flies off to some distant corner of the garden, out of sight. I watch it go, and I feel suddenly alone. A long bath fills the afternoon. I sink deep into sweet-smelling suds, kicking idly at the little glowing baubles as they bump against my toes. Ellie drags me out of the water before I go completely wrinkled and rubs creams into my skin and oils into my hair. I refuse to let her style my hair, however. Instead, I call a moon fire to life on the hearth, even though the room isn't yet dark, and I sit beside it. Its mild heat dries my hair gently as I comb it, leaving it smooth and shining with health. Finally, the sun finishes its slow journey across the sky and begins to sink. The colored patches of light from my window travel up the wall all the way to the ceiling, and I'm obliged to ask the moonfire to burn brighter before the room is totally lost in gloom. Ellie bustles in, carrying food from the courtyard feast. She burbles a great deal, but no amount of bullying or scolding can convince me to eat more than a few mouthfuls. I pick at a pastry, pulling it to pieces with my fingers. My eyes keep trying to drag my face around the dress on its mold. But no, I won't look at it, and I won't think about it either. After all, I'm not going down to the garden tonight. Am I? No, of course not. That would be ridiculous. I'm a prisoner. A captive. Lord Damaris, for all his courteous speeches, for all his demonstrations of admiration and kindness, for all the endearing timidity with which he extended his invitation, is a fey. He's tricked me into this marriage, stolen me away from the only life I've ever known, and I'm not going, I growl, turning the comb in my hands. I'm not. I sit a few moments longer, gazing into the fire. The moon will be out tonight. There's always a full moon on Glorind all night. Would the moonlight allow me to catch more than a glimpse of my shadow husband? Would such a sight go against the parameters of the curse? Not that it matters, because I'm not going. I get up, set the comb down on the table with a bang, then cross the room to my bed, tear off my gown, and toss it carelessly to the floor. I'm halfway into bed before I pause. My traitorous eyes turn against my will and look at the dress. It wouldn't hurt just to try it on, would it? 19. The fabric gathers gently on my right hip and flares away in layer after layer of shimmering softness. It's exactly what it's meant to be. No pleats, gods help me. Merely a gentle gather and a natural fall of shimmering, soft pink. I've added neither structuring frames nor lace petticoats to create volume. The layers themselves provide more than enough sweeping fullness, and they fall naturally, fluttering gently at the slightest movement. The bodice is slight and simple, a seam up the middle that stops between my breasts, then two panels that come to points at my shoulders. No sleeves other than the most delicate trailing of petals. The back drapes open far below my shoulder blades. It's a daring cut, nothing like the styles currently in mode back in my own world. And yet, each element is so graceful, so light. The overall effect is one of pure sweetness, like a spring flower newly budding. I give a twirl in front of the mirror. It's a silly, girlish gesture, one I've seen the ladies in Mistress Petrin's shop perform more times than I can count. I've never before had opportunity to do it myself, and I laugh at my own absurd enjoyment. My hair is loose down my back, and though I like the effect with the gown, such a style is not considered ladylike back home. You might not be back home, I mutter, using my hands to gather silky locks at the back of my head. But that doesn't mean you can't behave with proper decorum. I glance around the room, searching for a means to hold up my hair. I have a few ribbons I've been using to tie the end of my braid, but those aren't right. No. A gown like this deserves something better, something a little more. My gaze lands on the chest by the wall. I purse my lips, conflicted. Then, letting my hair fall, I pick up my skirts, cross the room, and kneel to toss back the lid. A quick rummage inside, and I find what I seek. A pair of simple silver combs edged in delicate white gems like tiny glinting stars. I turn the combs in my fingers, my lips pinched between my teeth. I promised myself I wouldn't touch any of the jewels, but these would suit the dress so well. And it's not like I'm going to keep them, I whisper, returning to the mirror. I'm just borrowing them for the night, that's all. Using the combs, I hastily twist and pin my hair half up. I can't gather all of it, not with only two combs, but the result is presentable, if perhaps a little simple. Lady Leoken wouldn't be caught dead out in public with a hairstyle like this, but Lady Leoken isn't here. Twisting, turning, I admire the dress and the combs from as many angles as I can manage. Then I stand and face myself straight on, looking into my reflected eyes. They seem odd in the moonfire light, dangerous somehow, as though the girl with those eyes might take rash chances. She's a girl who would dance in the moonlight with a fae. I smile a quick, furtive sort of smile. I don't have to dance, I say firmly, as though trying to convince myself. I'll simply stroll down, see the dancing lawn, speak to Lord Damaris, and return. A tiny flutter of guilt stirs in my heart, guilt that I should feel so much anticipation at the prospect. I quash the feeling. After all, I'm not intending to have fun. Not really. It's just a little walk. To satisfy my curiosity, nothing more. Skirts gathered in both hands, I step to the door. It opens at my command, and I pass into the corridor. A shiver runs down my spine. This is the first time I've stepped outside my room at night since arriving at Orokin. I feel reckless, and just the tiniest bit wild. Which is nonsense, of course. Shaking my head and taking care to settle my features into severe, dispassionate lines, I hasten down the left-hand corridor. Before I've reached the end, where it opens out onto the garden, music reaches my ears. A distant melody of pipes and drums. It's very like the music played on the village green back home. Very like, and yet utterly unlike. I reach the opening at the end of the corridor and stand at the top of the garden. My breath catches in my throat. The formal landscape lies before me, transformed under the silver light of the full moon. The blooming flowers seem to simmer with new life, an energy that pulses from their cores in radiating auras my eyes cannot quite see, but my spirit feels with an intensity far beyond sight. The tall trees and dense shrubs cast shadows darker than night itself and stretch long across the paths and lawns, yet the darkness serves only to make the stars shine so much brighter. The reflecting pool catches and holds the moon in a perfect reflection. A delicate wind whispers through the garden, dances across the pool, and hastens up the stone steps of the tears to tickle my face, bringing with it a delicious bouquet of perfumes. Altogether, it is intoxicating. I couldn't resist if I wanted to. And I don't really want to. Bunching up handfuls of skirts, I step out of the corridor and into the moonlight. I've taken the steps leading down the tiers to the reflecting pool many times by now. But tonight, it feels all new. My senses are alive and tingling. Glorindal night is a magical night, after all. Even back home, though I never danced, never joined the merrymakers in the village square, I always felt the magic brimming in my blood. Here, that feeling is so much stronger, as though barriers I never realized existed have been torn down. I walk alongside the reflecting pool, my bare feet silent on the white marble stones that line its edge. The massive fountain standing at the end of the pool is alive with flowing streams of moonlit water, which gurgle sweetly in rhythm with the music playing. And beyond the fountain in the wide, circular, dancing lawn are those men and women dancing in many concentric rings. My eyes widen in a futile effort to force my vision to see more clearly. Moonlight gleams on flashes of flowing gowns, wafting locks of hair, glittering jewels, lithe and graceful figures. But the glimpses are only momentary, perhaps nothing more than a trick of my moon-drunk mind. Resting my hand on the fountain's basin, I pause in its shadow, hesitant to step out into full view. The phantom figures on the lawn pay me no heed. They raise their arms above their heads, long sleeves and cloaks and capelets trailing like wings, then clap and whirl away. Circles blend into circles, forming patterns of such complexity, one would have to be a bird in the air above to fully appreciate the sight. Even from this less exalted perspective, it's a wonder to behold. For a while, I simply stand where I am, drinking in the sights, the sounds, the scents of the night. Slowly, however, I become aware of the golden figures of the fountain towering above me. I've looked at them many times before by daylight. They seem to be an artist's interpretation of some fey legend, winged heroes and heroines of old, locked in endless battle with horned and fork-tongued demons with long, claw-tipped fingers. I don't know the story, but several times while exploring the garden, I've lingered over the fountain, circling the basin to see the fantastical figures from different angles. And at some time during my studies, a subtle change crept over my perspective. Those horned beings, though very strange, are somehow more beautiful than their foes. Their faces reveal nobility that is lacking in the stern brows and ferocious glares of the elegantly winged men and women with which they battle. I've even dared to wonder if the horned ones might be the true heroes of the tale. Observing the fountain now, I frown. Though moonlight gleams on the topmost figures, those closer to the basin are cast in deep shadow. Am I mistaken? Or is there an extra horned head among the statues? My dry throat constricts. I swallow with some difficulty. Good evening, my lord, I say softly. For a moment, I fear my voice won't carry above the lilting pipes and the deep rumble of the drums. Then he answers,
Good evening, my lady.
There's a pause before his voice sounds again, deeper than the beat of the drums.
You came.
The shadowy figure moves slightly, the tips of its horns just catching a glint of moonlight. Unnerved, I draw back a step. It's like seeing the fountain statues coming to life, but Lord Damaris does not step out of the shadows.
The dress,
he says.
It is. You look lovely.
I flush and duck my head. Thank you, my lord. We are both silent then for a little while. I tear my gaze from the fountain and focus on the lawn. But I cannot concentrate on those flitting, mostly unseen figures. My awareness spikes at the nearness of his shadowy form. The song comes to an end. The phantom dancers raise their hands in a last clap, so perfectly simultaneously that it rings out across the garden, rolling away in a series of joyous echoes. Then they bow deeply or sweep graceful curtsies, which is like a dance in itself, before pairing off in couples and drifting off the lawn, their insubstantial images vanishing the moment they step from the circle. "Who are these people?" I ask, my voice soft in the following stillness.
"They are the folk of Oregon."
Lord Damaris' answer rumbles from the shadows.
"People under my care."
"Can they see us?"
"We appear to them only as shadows, much as they appear to us. They are near, however, only one fold of reality removed from us."
He pauses before adding,
"They are aware of your coming, and they are pleased."
My eyes struggle to make sense of the darkness and the moonlight, trying to catch another glimpse of the dancers. I see only the faintest flicker of movement beyond the edge of the dancing lawn, yet senses for which I have no name buzz with awareness, telling me that a great crowd stands and moves and speaks all around me. Are they as eager to catch a glimpse of me? Of their lord's human bride? I flush again and almost duck back behind the fountain.
"How do you like the music, m'lady?"
Glancing back up at the fountain, I can't quite determine which horned head belongs to a living being and not a figure of stone. "Very much," I say. "That last song reminded me of a tune they play back home on Glorindal night. The maiden and the..." My voice trails off.
"Go on,"
he prompts. Does he already know the song of which I speak? I lift my chin and continue more clearly. "The Maiden and the Shadow. It tells the story of a peerless lady whose father despairs because he can find no man fit for her to marry. He sends suitor after suitor to her, but she rejects them all. One day, a suitor comes to her in the garden, and the sun casts his shadow before him on the path. Seeing that shadow, her heart skips a beat, for she believes she has at last seen the man she can truly love." A thoughtful silence follows. Somewhere in the night, musicians test their instruments, strings and pipes experimenting with soft notes, seemingly at random, like nightbirds in the trees.
"What happened when she saw the man himself?"
Lord Damaris asks softly. Oh, seven gods. Why couldn't I have held my tongue? Why couldn't I have simply said I liked the song and left it at that? Or better still, why hadn't I maintained my resolve and stayed in my rooms all night? I tuck my chin. He could not measure up to the idea his shadow inspired in her heart. She wedded him even so, but died of sorrow soon after for love of someone who never existed. I wait, counting my own heartbeats. My eyes try to drag my head around to look up at the shadow and gauge his reaction, but I won't let them. I stare hard at the empty dancing lawn instead.
"Seems a sad tale to accompany such a lively tune,"
Lord Damaris says at last, his tone dry. "Yes, well, perhaps it would be too sad altogether if paired with an equally sad melody."
"Perhaps."
The musicians finish tuning and, after a short pause, begin another lively number. Shadowy figures appear on the edges of the dancing lawn, hastening to assume positions. As one, they link arms and begin to spin together, changing partners every few paces, forming another wildly complex and breathtaking pattern beneath the moon and stars. Painfully aware of the blush in my cheeks and grateful for the darkness to hide it, I watch silently. My bare foot taps in time to the beat of the drum. Suddenly, the figure seems to dim and almost vanish altogether. I blink and look up and see a wisp of cloud trailing across the moon, dragging larger, denser clouds in its wake. The music plays on, and I feel the pulse in the ground as the dancers stamp their feet. But I can no longer see them.
"Would you take a refreshment, m'lady?"
I start and step abruptly to one side, the soft folds of my skirt rustling. Lord Damara stands beside me, tall and indistinct, shrouded in night. I feel the intensity of his eyes looking down at me.
There is both food and drink,
he says. I can't see it.
No, it is in another fold, but I can draw it through.
I remember when I met him in the garden the first time. So long ago, it now seems. When his shadowy self handed me Brielle's letter. Yes, I say. All right. He waves an arm. I can just discern the sweep of a sleeve indicating which way I should walk. I lift the hem of my skirt and proceed with him around the edge of the dancing lawn until we stop beneath a spreading tree. I sniff experimentally. Beneath the heady aromas of the garden drifts the barest hint of sweets and savories and spices, just enough to make my mouth water.
Here.
The bulk that is Lord Damaris moves. The next moment, I can just see what looks like a crystal goblet before me.
This is Kay's, a traditional Glorindal brew. It should be safe for your consumption if you sip it slowly.
Should be. I pause, my fingers already closed around the goblet stem.
Taken in excess, it might drive you to a deep, dream-filled sleep. Many a mortal maid has lost her head sipping Kay's on Glorindal night. Go slowly.
If I were wise, I'd refuse the drink entirely, but I don't feel wise tonight. I feel reckless. I lift the cup to my lips and take an experimental sip. A burst of light and lightness and pure summertime fills my mouth so that I half wonder if my whole face is lit up in the darkness. I swallow, and warmth pours down my throat, pools in my gut, and seems to radiate out through every limb. Gods above! If a single sip affects me so profoundly, what would a whole goblet do? I blink, sputter a little, and an irrepressible smile pulls at my mouth. I raise the goblet, but before I can take another sip, long fingers close around my wrist.
Not too fast, m'lady.
I almost resist. After all, why should he give me the drink at all if I'm not to enjoy it? But no. I already feel as though I could spread my arms, sprout wings, and fly. Best not to push my luck. I relax my fingers, allowing him to take the goblet away. He plies me with food next, delicacies both sweet and savory, each no more than a single mouthful, so that my tongue is always left wanting more. But the next delicacy comes, replacing the craving for the first, and so on until I'm almost exhausted by the sheer variety. Enough, enough, I cry when I've taken the tenth of these delicious mouthfuls. I'm thirsty now. Lord Damaris grunts, and the goblet appears before me again.
It should be safe enough for you to have another taste.
Delighted, I gulp a large mouthful this time, closing my eyes as the sunshine and brightness fills me up and pulses through my veins. A little gasp of a laugh escapes my lips, and I flush, press two fingers to my mouth, then shake my head and laugh again.
That is enough, I think.
Lord Damaris again draws the goblet from my reluctant fingers.
I fear it is too strong for you, m'lady. You are so slight and unused to our fare. Would you care for some water instead?
I care for a dance. The song has ended. Though I cannot see them, I feel the unseen dancers dispersing. The dancing lawn is empty beneath the moon-shrouded sky. Lord Damaris stands beside me in the darkness. He is very still. I cannot even hear him breathe. Come. I say, laughing again, a bright, golden laugh. Dance with me! I gather my skirts and skip slightly from beneath the spreading tree out into the middle of the empty lawn. There I fling out my arms, toss back my head, and twirl. This is what this lovely gown was made for. Movement. Free and light and full of untethered joy. No somber prisoner would dare to wear a gown like this. It is a gown fit for a bride. So I close my eyes and spin again, breathing in the scents of the night, reveling in the softness of my petal skirts against my legs, the bite of cool wind against my bare arms. As I spin, a single bar-on drum begins to beat a deep, throbbing rhythm that captures my feet. My toes skip and dance through the grass in time to that beat. The pipes join in, and delicate strings blend together into a full symphony of sound. I let the music carry me. I've never danced on Glorindal night before, yet somehow my spirit seems to know the steps. Suddenly, a hand is around my waist. I turn sharply, gaze up into deep, featureless shadow, and my face splits in a smile. My other hand is caught in a long-fingered grip. Then I'm spun across the dancing lawn, my stomach pitching with delightful sensations at every whirl. The music wraps around us, so bright, so golden, it seems to be made of strands of light. The only truly visible thing in all the darkened garden. I close my eyes and let the song sweep me away. My hair floats in ripples around my shoulders, and my many-layered skirts flutter like blossoms in a sudden breeze. Wilder and wilder the music swells, and the hand holding mine lets go and grips my waist. I reach up, catching hold of solid, muscled shoulders, and gasp in delight as I'm lifted right off my feet, caught in a heady whirl of darkness and song. The music comes to an end. Distantly, as though from a world away, I think perhaps I hear a sound like applause, but that may have been nothing more than the murmur of the fountain. My feet are still off the ground as I'm carried around in one final turn. Then slowly, unhurried, those strong arms lower me until the grass tickles my bare toes. I stumble to catch my balance and fall against the tall figure. For a moment, my cheek presses against bare, warm skin. I feel the thud of a heartbeat. My eyes flare open. With a little gasp, I step back, but my fingers tighten their grip on the silk-clad shoulders. I stare up at the shape looming over me, trying to see something, anything, but it's too dark. I can discern no more than a faint silhouette and the outline of two great curved horns above me. It's too strange, too frightening, so I close my eyes, tilting my head back. My breath comes in short bursts, my lungs struggling to catch up after that wild exertion. In the silence left behind by the music, I hear his deep breathing. It rumbles in the pit of my stomach.
Valera.
His voice reaches out to me along that invisible cord of connection stretched between us. He's not spoken my name in days. I'd almost forgotten how it feels, how my body and soul respond to the sound. One of the two hands holding my waist lets go. The next moment, something touches my cheek. A rounded knuckle that turns gently as it trails down my face. A light, delicate touch.
Valera,
he says again.
Valera, I...
His fingertip traces the line of my jaw, then under my chin. I catch my breath. That's when I feel it. The sharp edge of a claw. I release my hold on his shoulders and step back quickly. The hand on my waist immediately lets go. My cheek burns as though on fire, and that place on my chin throbs as though in pain, though when my trembling fingers touch the spot, I feel no blood. I'm tired, I say. I back away several more paces, my fingers clenching in the folds of my skirts. Good night, my lord. Whirling on my heel, I lift the front hem of my skirts and all but run across the lawn. The clouds disperse. Moonlight floods the gardens once more, gleaming bright on the horned and winged figures on the fountain. I don't look behind me. I don't try to catch a last glimpse of the dancing figures making their way back onto the green. I don't try to see the lanterns of moonfire or the shimmering flowers with their otherworldly glow. If I look, the moonlight might reveal the face of my bridegroom, and that goes against the bonds of our marriage. So I flee along the edge of the long reflecting pool and find the stairs leading up through the garden tiers. I don't stop until I reach the safety of my room and stand with my back pressed against the door, my chest rising and falling as I struggle to reclaim my breath. One hand moves almost against my will, touching that place on my cheek, his knuckle so gently grazed. It still feels warm somehow. 20. The next day passes in a blur. Worn out from the night before, I remain in bed a long while, sleeping and sometimes drifting into a half-wakeful, dozing state. Several times, I open my eyes and look across the room to the dress displayed on its mold. A little smile twitches the corner of my mouth, and I quickly turn and bury my face in my pillow, drifting back to sleep. Late in the morning, Ellie bullies me out of bed and into the bath. I linger there longer than usual as well, until the bubbles have all reduced to scummy suds, and even the little glowing orbs have lost interest in me and rest at the bottom of the pool. Still I sit, trailing my fingers in the water. I close my eyes and hear again the sweet songs of pipes and the pulse of drums rolling in my gut. I feel again the sensation of strong hands on my waist, lifting me in the air so high I might have spread my arms and flown away into the dark sky. Ellie's burbling voice brings me round again. Flushing, I look up at that green face and the irritable, bobbing antennae. "Sorry, Ellie," I say, climbing out of the water and allowing the nymph to pat me down with soft towels. "I don't know what's gotten into me today." I drift between malaise and dreamy euphoria throughout the afternoon, eating little despite Ellie's stern chortles. The goblin men try to entertain me with new acrobatic feats, but I hardly see them and leave the table in the courtyard with scarcely a word of thanks or appreciation. The goblins mutter behind me, but I hurry on my way without bothering to apologize, without trying to explain myself. Really, what is there to explain? I make my way back down the corridor of stained glass windows, bypassing my room and continuing on to the garden. It looks so different by daylight, beautiful, but no longer brimming with dangerous enchantment. Though I strain my ears, I can detect not even the faintest echo of the music that so thrilled me last night. Venturing down the tiers, I proceed along the edge of the reflecting pool, beneath the shade of the flowering trees. Though my eyes dart at each shadow, I catch no glimpse of a phantom-like silhouette. Probably just as well. I have things to consider, thoughts to mull over, best not to be distracted. When I arrive at the fountain, sunlight glints off the golden limbs and heads and horns. The glare too bright, too dazzling for my eyes to rest on for more than momentary glances. The air is uncomfortably warm under that direct heat, but I sit on the edge of the basin and dip my hand in the water, which is deliciously cool. After a while, I look up. Here on the shadowed side of the fountain, the golden figures aren't too bright for my eye, and I peer at them closely. Particularly those horned devils with their forked tongues and clawed hands. The little thrill that had nestled in my gut all morning turns to a coil of dread. Ducking my head, I bend over the basin, cupping cool water to my mouth. I pause with my hand still upraised, touching my lips with damp fingers.
I must give you my name before I may kiss you thrice, and then I must wait until you ask me to kiss you a fourth time. Can I do it? Last night, I'd almost believed I could. No. No, that wasn't true. Last night, I'd wanted to. The temptation was intense, intensified still more by the delicious flow of K.E.'s in my veins. I'd wanted to ask right then and there, while the moon's face was hidden by the clouds and the echoes of the dancing music still swelled in the air around us. But it wouldn't be just one kiss. I'm not a fool. If I ask for the fourth kiss, I'm asking for everything. Asking for the marriage to be made true. Asking for my bridegroom to take me as his bride. My gaze flicks up to the horned man on the fountain and away again. It would break the curse. I'm almost sure of it. And when it's over, when the fourth kiss and all the kisses that follow come to an end, what then? Having gotten what he wants from me, will he do as he promised and deliver me to my father's doorstep? Is that what I want? Of course it is. I give my head a fierce shake and stand abruptly, backing away from the fountain and wiping my wet hand on my skirts. Of course you want to go home. That's all you want. And the sooner you do, the better. The better for Brielle, the better for him, the better for you. My brow furrowed. I turn away from the fountain and its golden figures, making my way back through the garden and into the safety of my rooms. Ellie is there, straightening and tidying, but takes one look at my face and, with a polite trill of burbles, bows out. Feeling a little too hot and sweaty after my walk, I sit in my chair before the empty fireplace, glaring at nothing in particular. Then I blink and sit up a little straighter. My gaze has been unconsciously fixed on the empty seat across from mine, the seat where, every night, a dark, featureless shadow takes his ease. Twilight comes at last, dimming the world. I don't venture out for dinner, and Ellie does not come to fetch me. Eventually, I rise and return to the bathing room, taking my time over a second bath to wash away the heat and sweat from the garden. When I climb out of the water, I don't immediately don my regular work gown, but sit a little while wrapped in a towel, combing my hair. Then, my jaw set, I return to the bedchamber, march to the clothing chest, and throw back the lid. My fingers rummage down inside until they touch something at the bottom. With a tug, I pull out the seamless white garment that had been left for me on my very first night in Oricon. Even after several weeks crushed at the bottom of the chest, it is unwrinkled and lovely. My heart beating fast, I drop my towel and slide my arms into the garment. It has no laces or buckles or buttons. It simply wraps in the front, crossing in a deep V over my breast, and ties on the opposite hip. It's deliciously soft and delicate. When I take a step, the front splits, exposing much of my leg. I stop short, heat rising in my face. I pull in both lips, biting down hard. Then, straightening my shoulders and taking smaller steps, I return to my chair by the fire and perch on its edge, taking care that the silky dress doesn't open or expose too much. After all, I've made no decision. Not yet. The room darkens. Twilight gives way to night. I call up the moonfire on my hearth, but only a little blaze, just enough to glow on the whiteness of my gown. I feel very visible. The moment he steps through the door, he can't help but see me, see what I wear. Maybe I ought to get up and change, now before it's too late. I turn to my seat, looking back across the room. My work dress lies atop the chest.
But what if he enters the room while I'm still slipping out of this garment? No, better to hold very still, make no promises or decisions. After all, it was just a dance. That's all. And I was more than a little tipsy, and the music had gone to my head, and the moonlight had dazzled my brain, and when all those elements are removed, what's left? Little enough. A dance. Nothing more. The fire burns down on the hearth. My eyes grow heavy. I adjust slightly, leaning back in my seat, and watch the fire flicker. My ears prick for the sound of the door opening. My fingers run along the soft folds of the white gown, and I idly wonder if I could learn the trick of creating a garment without seams. Maybe it's magic. Maybe it's... maybe... With a gasp, I open my eyes and sit upright. The fire is out. Pale sunlight pours through my stained glass window, casting colored shapes on the floor. I blink blearily and rub my sore neck, then press a hand to the small of my aching back. Seven gods, did I fall asleep in the chair? Then I look down and catch my breath. Gods above, what am I wearing? Oh, that's right. Heat flushes in my cheeks. My gaze flicks to the empty seat across from me. Still empty. But that's just as well, isn't it? I wasn't fully myself last night. Maybe the KEs was still working its way through my system, making me reckless. So yes, it's just as well that he didn't come last night, didn't find me in this revealing garment. Just as well I'd not faced the moment of choice that I'm totally unprepared to make. Just as well. Yes. I stand, rolling my stiff neck and shoulders. Time to get out of this white gown and hide it back in the chest before Ellie finds me in it. She reports to her master every night. I can't have her reporting things that simply aren't worth mentioning. I take one step toward the chest where my work gown waits, then pause. Frowning slightly, I turn to the little table covered with odds and ends from my sewing projects, thread and thimbles and needles and trimmings, all the regular detritus of a seamstress's trade. In its center sits something that wasn't there before, something I didn't put there. A black box, unadorned save for a simple gold latch. How did it get here? Did Ellie slip in while I slept, or had... No, it couldn't have been Lord Damaris. Surely I'd have noticed if he entered my room. Something in the air would have awakened me. Or maybe he came, saw me in this white gown, and left again, without a word. My lips pressed into a hard line. I pluck the box from the table and almost rebelliously undo the latch and toss back the lid. Inside, on a plush red cushion, lies a necklace. A gold necklace hung with seven oval charms. What in the world? I set the box down and lift the necklace free, holding the charms close to my face. An image is etched into the surface of each one. Sun, moon, stars. Those I recognize well enough. Another looks like drops of rain. Another, a tongue of flame. Another just seems to be whirling lines. A wind, perhaps? The charm in the center has no mark. Its surface is perfectly smooth. Is this another gift? But why? Lord Damaris knows how little I care for jewelry. Or had he caught sight of the silver combs in my hair on Glorindal night and believed I'd had a change of heart? Even so, this is an odd, simple piece compared to the glittering gems and elaborate settings now stashed inside my chest. The light from the window catches on the charms. I tilt my head, noticing something I'd not seen at first glance. Each of the charms has what looks like a seam running around its circumference. Are they lockets? A little fumbling, and I managed to get the first one, the one with the whirling decorative lines, to spring open. Instantly, something bursts in my face and whirls around my head. With a cry of surprise, I leap back, dropping the locket as my hair is dragged straight up in a coil. The something rises until it hits the ceiling, then darts across the room, bouncing off the mirror, making it rock on its stand. It spins around the pink gown to the dress mold, and the skirt flares and flutters. Hardly thinking what I'm doing, I lunge across the room and grab at invisible nothing. My hand closes around something solid, graspable. For a moment, I stand in dumb shock, my mouth hanging open. Wind! The word whispers from my lips. I'm holding on to wind! It's as soft as newly carded flax, and so fine my eye can scarcely discern it. Though it seemed large and gusting before, it's now a mere flickering breath that wafts and moves as though not entirely inclined to escape, but wanting to put on a show of rebellion nonetheless. Fabric woven of wind. Impossible. And so incredibly beautiful. A smile breaks across my face, driving out all my embarrassment, all the inexplicable unhappiness I felt upon waking in this empty room. My mind churns with new thoughts, new ideas. When has a mortal seamstress ever had opportunity to hold such a wonder? Somehow, I can't even begin to describe how, I fold the wind, making it smaller and smaller. It yields to my touch until I've got it small enough to fit neatly back inside the locket. The gold clasp shuts with a satisfying click. I stare at it, then at the six other lockets. Do they also contain fabrics? Threads spun of starlight and moonlight and flames, woven together into the finest, most incredible textiles. Can I, a human armed only with needle and thread, actually make something of them? My smile grows. I feel it, foolish and unstoppable, covering my whole face. Maybe I'm wrong to indulge in such delight. Maybe I'm wrong to succumb so easily to fey enticements. I can't help it. In a small, bitter, far back corner of my heart, a part I hardly dare admit even exists, I acknowledge the truth. I don't want to go home. Not yet. Just not yet. 21. After donning my work gown and stashing the white garment back in the bottom of my chest like a dirty secret, I spend the morning opening each locket by turn and examining its contents. The only one I shy away from is the locket with the flame emblem. That one I might save until I have a bit more experience with magical fabrics. The others are delightful, however. Cloth of twinkling starlight, more brilliant than diamonds. Cloth of sunshine, more dazzling than gold. The water droplet locket proves to hold a cloth of fine mist that settles around me, damp and close, obscuring the walls of my room entirely from view. It leaves dewdrops behind on everything, even after I've folded and stashed it away. The final locket, the one with no marking emblem, is the most interesting of all. When I first peer inside, it seems empty. Then I happen to spy an extra shadow lying on the floor beside mine, a shapeless lump like a pile of rumpled cloth fallen unheeded. Shadow, I whisper, reaching and picking it up. It's a little rough against my fingertips, the warp and weft quite dense. Interesting. I drape it around my shoulders, and my eyes widen with surprise. Curious, I get up from my seat, approach the mirror, and give a startled cry. Only my disembodied head is visible in the glass. I shrug out of the cloth and am obliged to wait for my heart to stop racing before I have the courage to pick it up and stuff it back into its locket. The rest of the day I spend with chalk in hand, sketching ideas on the wall of my room. Ellie enters several times, bearing food and scolding when I eat only a few mouthfuls. But she seems to recognize that her human charge is once more lost to the enthrallment of creative inspiration. After a few futile burbles, she gives up and leaves me be. By dusk, I collapse in my seat by the fire, my fingers white with chalk, my head spinning. Designing a dress for the pink petal fabric was simplicity itself in comparison to this task. Nothing in my training or experience has prepared me to work with fabrics of this kind. How does one make a garment out of wind? And what sort of garment would be suited to wind anyway? Darkness closes in. Night falls. Eventually, the storm in my brain fades, replaced by that strange, fever-like heat beneath my skin that plagued me last night. Lord Damaris will come soon. Surely he will. I look down at my work gown, then cast a glance across the room to the chest. No. No, I won't change into the white gown. Not tonight. Shaking my head, I settle back into my chair, gripping the arms hard. I won't give in to the wildness brought on by Glorindal Knight. I will simply talk to my bridegroom, thank him for his handsome gifts, maybe ask him a few questions, learn what manner of garments the Fae usually make out of wind and mist and starlight. Keep the conversation easy and natural, with no reference to that dance, no reference to that moment when the music stopped, when I stumbled, when my cheek pressed against his chest, when I felt his heartbeat surging. There's no need to talk about such things. I wait until the fire burns down to nothing. Then I wait a while longer. At last, I remove my outer gown and climb alone into my enormous bed. I lie in the darkness a long while, my eyes open, while visions of shadows seem to dance in my head. When will Lord Damaris return? I sit in my usual place by the empty hearth, my work paused in my lap. Even while resting, my fingers must keep a tight grip on the wind fabric, which pulls and struggles, taking every opportunity to escape. I've managed to bind it with a bit of silver thread, my stitches a bit more erratic than my professional pride likes. Getting used to sewing a wind will take some practice. I look up from my stitching to where Ellie stands in the bathroom doorway, her arms full of empty bottles and discarded towels. The green woman's antennae waft, and her large black eyes blink slowly at me. Lord Damaris, I repeat. Your master. Does he often go away like this? It's been more than a week now. More than a week since that heady dance in the gardens on Glorindal night. And not once has the shadowy figure of my bridegroom paid me a call. I've almost stopped looking for him. I can recall only one other time that he left for this long, soon after my arrival in Orokin. Otherwise, he has been faithful in his nightly visits. It's not as though I truly miss him, of course. Now that I've had time to let the enchantment of Glorindal fade from my blood, I know better than to give such feelings any credit. They stem from nothing more than a temporary madness. Still, it does seem rather odd. Odd that he would simply disappear like this, with no word of explanation, with no hint of when I might expect to see him again. Ellie tilts her head, blinks again, then babbles something in her lilting language. Her antennae wave in such a way as to imply a shrug, and she saunters from the room, still burbling. It sounds like a string of complaints, but beyond that, I have no guesses. Maybe she doesn't care for her master's mysterious doings either. My mouth pursing in an irritable frown, I turn back to my sewing. The wind struggles and several of my stitches loosen, the seam threatening to tear apart. Wretched thing, I mutter, glad to have an outlet for my frustration. Hold still, why don't you? It's not as though it hurts. I've almost got a... I stop. My head slowly rises, my work dropping into my lap. What is that sound? The wind gives a gusting burst, reclaiming my attention. Hastily, I lay the bundle, needle and all, on my side table and pin it under a heavy, polished weight that Bergabog brought me specifically for this purpose. Then I stand, my head tilted, listening closely. There it is again. Distant. More like a feeling than a sound. A rumbling in the floor, through the walls. Ellie? I call out. Ellie, do you hear that? No answering burble comes. Just a long silence. Then once again, a vibration, an echo. It feels strangely familiar. I hurry to my door and peer out into the corridor of windows. All is still, the colored glass bright with sunlight streaming through. Frowning, I hasten down the corridor out to the courtyard. There, I feel the vibration again, stronger this time, and accompanied by a faint but distinct sound. Boom. 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 Three times, sharp and crisp. Then another pause. Then three times again, the same sound. Boom. 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 Is someone knocking on the front door? I turn in place, looking up and down the courtyard for some sign of goblins or nymphs. Does anyone hear that? My voice echoes along the colonnades and up to the empty windows above. No one answers. Boom. 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 I haven't ventured to that huge entrance hall since I found it, the day after finishing the petal gown. But my feet seem to remember the way, and I dart swiftly across the courtyard, through the series of spacious, elegant rooms, and finally come within sight of those huge double doors. For a moment, I stand looking at them, my brow puckered with uncertainty. Boom. 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 Yes. Someone, something, is out there, knocking. I swallow. It can't be wise to open the door. Who can say what stands on the other side? Some monster crawled from the hidden depths of Whispering Wood, no doubt. I should turn right around, return to my room, shut the door, and wait for whoever or whatever it is to go about their business. Then again, what if it's someone lost in the wood? Someone seeking shelter from the terrors and shadows, who, spying a break in the trees, spying a house ahead, came rushing to this doorstep hoping for aid? What if it's Brielle? I whisper. Now the idea has entered my head. I can't dislodge it. This doesn't mean I'm going to be stupid, however. I set my jaw, curl my hands tightly in the folds of my skirts, and march to the door. Standing with my ear against it, I strain to discern something about whatever or whoever stands on the far side. Boom. 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 I stagger back. That knock seemed to land directly where my ear rested. Drawing a steadying breath, I call, "Who's there?" After a pause, "I am not in the habit of giving my name to any who ask. I stand on the threshold of my friends. They should know me within." The voice speaking is a woman's, yet cold and deep, utterly imperious. The sound reverberates into my very bones, making me quake with my own unworthiness. Such a voice is not meant to be questioned. Such a voice is meant to be obeyed. I glimpse my hand reaching for the door latch. With an effort of will, I draw it back and clasp both hands tightly behind my back. "What do you want?" I inquire, hoping my voice doesn't sound as thin and nervous through the door as it does in my own ears. Another pause lasts a little longer than the first. Something about that silence distinctly emanates indignation. Finally, the voice says, "Who are you to question me thus? My family?" the word is spoken as though it is in itself a name, has never been barred access by the Lords of Orican. I step back, my brow furrowing. Something about that voice is not right. Something I can't name. It feels as though it's trying to get inside my head. Do the words hold magic? Insidious, ensorceling magic? I'm sorry. I speak clearly, though my voice trembles despite my best efforts. The master of the house is not home at present. I mean no offense, but I cannot open his door to just anyone. This time, the silence on the other side feels strangely contemplative. Then the voice speaks again. And are you Lord Damaris's new young bride? I catch a quick, startled breath. But why should I be surprised? While my experiences since passing through Whispering Wood have been limited to Orican, Lord Damaris must have a life and connections reaching far beyond the boundaries of his house. Word of his marriage was bound to get about eventually. I suddenly feel small, very small, and trapped. Recently, the boundaries of this strange new world have seemed less confining. In fact, I've enjoyed a measure of liberty since coming here that would have been impossible to imagine while living under Father's roof. But the truth remains. I'm a prisoner, held against my will by my so-called husband. I stare at the door, which is richly paneled with ornate gold moldings in the shape of blooming lilies and birds. My mind spins, but I can't think of anything to say. Your silence is answer enough, the voice on the far side muses. I heard rumors of you. I thought perhaps you might be lonely out here by yourself, so I came to pay my respects and wish you well. Do open the door and let me in. We can sit a while and get to know one another. I still don't answer. My hand seems to move of its own volition toward the huge door latch. Wait. No, this is not what I want to do. Imperious voice notwithstanding, the person on the other side of that door could be anyone or anything. I'm no fool. I step back and put my hands behind my back, clasping them tight. Perhaps you have questions about your lordly husband. Even through the door, it's a rich voice, deep as a red wine. I have known dear Damaris for many a long age now. I could tell you such tales. Please, my dear, allow me to shed some light on your curiosity. Once more, I find myself strongly inclined to open the door. I squeeze my hands tighter, refusing to surrender to the impulse. My mouth opens, but every word that springs to my lips seems suddenly perilous, as though the mere speaking of them will